From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now, here's your host, Mark Kepler.
Proposition 13, passed in 1978, transformed the relationship between state and local government and fundamentally changed the way that California property owners are taxed and how local government services are funded. Not surprisingly, Proposition 13 continues to be controversial almost 40 years on. How has Prop 13 impacted property owners and local governments? Has it helped or hurt local business owners, developers, and homeownership? We'll ask our guests, Brian Euler and Carolyn Chu from the nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office, who recently authored a report on Prop 13.
We'll also hear from Liam Dillon with the LA Times and John Kapal with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. And we'll get political analysis from Dan Walters of Cal Matters and John Myers of the LA Times.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Perhaps no proposition has received more notoriety as an expression of direct democracy and ballot box budgeting, for good and bad, than Proposition 13 passed in 1978. A recent report by the nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office examined Proposition 13 and how it's affected the way people live and how state and local government actually do business. Our guests are the authors of that report. Brian Euler, welcome, Brian.
Thank you for having us.
And Carolyn Chu, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Brian, I'll start with you. Let's put property taxes in perspective. How much money do property taxes generate every year, and what percentage of the state budget are property taxes?
About statewide, property taxes raise about $55 billion per year. And to put that in perspective, all local governments' total revenues are about $200 billion, and the state's general fund revenues are about $120 billion.
So it's not the most important state tax, right? Personal income tax.
It's the second largest government revenue source in the state.
Second's important. That's still pretty good. So I want to ask you, property taxes were a very contentious issue leading up to the passage of Proposition 13 in 1978. How were they calculated? How were property taxes calculated before Proposition 13, and why was it such a volatile issue?
Every property owner's property tax bill is the product of basically two numbers. One is their tax rate, and the other is the assessed value of their property. And prior to Prop 13, each property owner's tax rate was essentially the sum of the tax rate levied by each individual local government serving their property. So
there could be variances.
That's right. Each property might be served by a city and a county and maybe a fire district or in a school district or some other special districts. And each property owner paid a rate that was the sum of each of those levies, and there was variation across each property owner. And then the value of each property was determined based on its market value, or basically what the property owner could sell for at that time. And the product of those two things was the property owner's tax bill.
And the market value was determined by who? Was that the local official?
That's right, by the county assessors. They determined the market
value.
Okay,
and so, yeah, it depends on the assessor you have, I suppose, what they value the property. So Carolyn, you get Proposition 13. Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of changes. What were the basic provisions of Proposition 13?
For the basic provisions of Proposition 13 as they relate to the property tax, the first was that it changed, it limited the overall property tax rate to 1%. So as Brian explained, each local government could levy its own rate, set its own rate sort of based on its needs for its services.
Prior
to 13. And then 13 said the sum of those rates cannot exceed 1%. So not only did it reduce overall rates, before Proposition 13, rates were about 2.6%, and Proposition 13 lowered them down to 1%.
Well, that's a big cut. I mean, you know, it's almost a two-thirds cut.
Correct. So the other element of Proposition 13 was that it changed the basis for calculating the property tax rate. So before, as Brian explained, property taxes were based on the market value of property, and Proposition 13 said property values will be based on the acquisition value, so what you bought your home for.
What you actually sell it for.
What you bought your home for.
Oh, I'm sorry, bought it for.
What you bought it for, and then it allowed for a 2% increase or inflation, whichever was lower, annually. So
after that.
So it, no longer would your property taxes be based on the market value. They'd be based on this adjusted acquisition value.
So I think almost immediately then there was going to be a drop in tax property tax revenue. I think I read in your report 60% drop.
That's right. The property tax revenues for local governments at the time Proposition 13 passed dropped about 60%. In addition, that meant that the property tax payments by property owners also dropped by about 60%. So local government's revenues went down, but people's property tax bills also went down.
And there was another thing. You were very specific about saying this is what it did to property taxes, but Proposition 13 also did something else, and that was the two-thirds vote requirement. Can you briefly explain that?
Sure. So Proposition 13 required two-thirds voter approval for special taxes. So it imposed this new voter approval for special taxes levied by local governments.
And special taxes are taxes, what, levied for a specific purpose?
Correct.
Okay. So what were the implications then for taxpayers and local governments? So we see a 60% drop in taxes.
Correct.
For individuals. Mm-hmm. What else?
So property taxes declined by about 60% for local governments and for taxpayers. Proposition 13 also said the state shall allocate the revenues from the property tax.
I think I'm hearing something here, and that is he who has the gold makes the rules.
Yes.
So it shifted, I'm assuming it shifted power then to the state.
Well, so the proposition directed the state to allocate the revenues, and what the state did was it essentially said your share of the 1% rate will be the same as it was before 13. So if in your county, you, relative to all your other local governments, got about 30% of the property tax revenue, after 13, you would still get about 30% of the property tax revenue, but it would be of this new lower rate overall. And essentially, that was locked in since Proposition 13 passed. What local governments got then, they continued to get into the future.
Okay, so that kind of, I assume that it's kind of shifted, I think we're going to have a conversation on how it shifted away from property taxes to other kind of levies by local governments, I assume.
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a moment. Thank you for the basics of Prop 13. So how have property owners fared under Prop 13? That was the focus. That was the point. We'll have that conversation in a moment. This is the Mattie Report. Welcome back. Proposition 13 was squarely aimed at property taxes. What impact has it had on property owners? Our guests are Brian Euler and Carolyn Chu with the Nonpartisan State Legislative Analyst Office. They recently authored a report assessing Prop 13 40 years after its passage. So Brian, you know, one of the things you hear sometimes is that under Prop 13, similar property owners are taxed differently. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. And I think it's a product of the fact that Prop 13 is an acquisition value system, that what your tax bill is based on essentially what you paid for your property adjusted for inflation over time. And what happens with that is essentially the amount of tax relief that is provided to you by Prop 13 as compared to what you would be paying under a market value system like we had before Prop 13, it grows the longer you own your property.
And so if you bought a house in San Francisco for $100,000, you know, umpteen years ago, you're paying, the property value is $100,000. Until it's sold.
Right, or 100,000 adjusted by about 2%
a year. Okay, 2%,
right.
2%.
But still.
But inflation generally runs more than 2% a year, so you're doing well if you're holding on to
it. That's right. In most cases, in the vast majority of cases, for people who have owned their property for several years, they're taxed at a value that's far below what the market, what they could sell for today. And because of that, you wind up with differences in property taxes paid by owners of similar properties, simply based on how long they've owned the property.
So you could have, you know, same income, same age, same basic wealth, but you could pay vastly different property taxes.
That's right. Yeah, and that is one thing that we found, that some people might assume that the differences are just a function of people's age, that older homeowners are more likely to own their homes for longer, and therefore they're the ones who are receiving the benefit. But in fact, we looked at a similar age cohort in the Bay Area who own, you know, about a median priced home, and found that the property taxes varied from under $1,500 to over $7,500.
That's quite the range.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing about Prop 13, the tax relief, I'm wondering if it varies from income, and if so, who benefits? Do higher income people benefit? Do lower income people benefit more from Prop 13?
Well, what we saw when we looked at the data was essentially these tax benefits are pretty much proportional to the amount of home wealth you have. And perhaps unsurprisingly, higher income Californians have more home wealth. They're more likely to own a home, and the homes that they do own are
homes plural. They could own more than one home.
That's true, yeah. And so Because of that, and the fact that we found that essentially these tax benefits are roughly proportional to the amount of home wealth you own, that the total dollar amount of tax benefit was highest for high-income Californians. About 50% of the total dollar of tax benefit was going to Californians with incomes of $120,000.
Yeah, I see. The bulk of the relief in your report says goes to people with incomes in excess of $120,000. And so I think you even made an example of a person who makes less than $50,000, I think it was. They have a typical home that's much less expensive than someone making, you know, $500,000, and so therefore they don't benefit as much on Prop 13 as the wealthy person. You know, but it does seem that, you know, a lot of people that rent, and wealthy people do own rental property. So if they're getting a break on their rental property taxes, maybe that passes on to the renters. Did you find that?
There's certainly that argument has been made that is a potential benefit of Prop 13. It's something that's pretty hard to measure, and it wasn't something that we were able to quantify in our report. You know, we do see that there is this potential argument that a landlord who's facing a lower property tax bill might pass on some of that benefit to the renter, but to the extent to which that happens in practice, we weren't really able to
define completely. Yeah. Okay, so what about this, though? It seems that from what you're telling me that there's a certain incentive to hold on to property longer. Is that true?
Yeah, so like I said, your tax benefit from Prop 13 essentially is a function of how long you've owned your home. So the longer you've owned it, the greater benefit you have. And if you were to move, that tax benefit essentially resets to zero. You start paying taxes again on the market value of your home, which will be what you paid for it in that year. And so that does ostensibly create a disincentive for people to move. And we did find that in the data, for example, if you look at the turnover in properties immediately prior to Prop 13, about 16% of properties statewide were sold. And in the most recent year of data, we saw that only about 5% of properties turned over. So a significant decline in the number of properties that are turning over.
There's also something about people over 55, that there's a big change from 54 to 55. What was that about?
That's right. So California, subsequent amendments to Prop 13 have allowed homeowners over 55 to essentially transfer their tax benefit to a new home to try to allow them to, you know, sort of allow an empty nester to downsize to a smaller retirement home, say. And we found that there's a significant jump in the number of homeowners that are moving, the likelihood that a homeowner will move when you go from 54 to 55, sort of suggesting that you had a lot of homeowners that were holding out because they didn't want to lose their tax benefit.
They want the tax benefit. Yeah. Well, Carolyn, let me ask you. You found that after Proposition 13, residential properties paid more than commercial and industrial properties, a larger share of property taxes. How big is that difference, and is Prop 13 exclusively to blame here?
Well, so what we looked at was the share of property taxes paid by homeowners specifically. So homeowners living in owner-occupied homes, not residential properties overall. Unfortunately, we can't quite measure that. But in terms of homeowners, what we saw was that the share of property taxes paid by homeowners did increase slightly from about 32% in the early 80s to about 37% today. What we saw, though, was that the number of residential properties has increased far more than the number of commercial.
Well, the only thing about that number, about that 37%, is really not that far off pre Prop 13. It was about 34%, you said, I think,
in
your report.
That's right. Yeah, it is. So it's some growth. So, but what we saw is that there's also been a much larger growth in the number of residential properties as compared to commercial industrial properties. So the number of residential properties has increased about 60%.
So it's not surprising that they're paying a little bit larger share.
Right. Compared to commercial industrial properties. Some have thought that commercial industrial properties are paying a smaller share of property taxes today than before 13, mm-hmm. because in theory, commercial and industrial properties can own properties for longer. So the benefits they receive from this acquisition value calculation would be greater because in theory they would own the properties for longer than residential properties. What we saw in the data, however, was that the relative turnover rates between commercial and for commercial and industrial properties compared to residential properties really wasn't that different, that they were turning over at relatively similar rates.
But we're going to talk about that in a moment, how Proposition 13 has either helped or hurt new housing and business creation. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. Proposition 13 has appeared to lower property taxes, but has that encouraged or discouraged housing development and business creation? Our guests are authors of a recent report on Proposition 13, Brian Euler and Carolyn Chu from the Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office. So Brian, let me ask you this. It seems like new businesses, they're going to have to purchase property. And so they seem to be at a competitive disadvantage to others who have been in the business for a while. They don't have to buy new property. So they are paying higher, new businesses are paying higher property taxes, bottom line. So has that discouraged new business creation?
So what we were able to look at some data on comparing areas that had a high concentration of tenured businesses, lots of existing businesses that were receiving a high amount of tax benefit from Prop 13, and comparing that to areas that had more concentration of newer businesses to see, did it look like new business creation was being discouraged from the places where there were lots of existing businesses? And we didn't see any difference in business formation across those areas, sort of suggesting that this differential treatment in taxes wasn't
the property tax issue is not a big deal, apparently, for these startups. Well, let me ask you this. Has Prop 13 altered the way property owners develop their properties, making their property decisions?
All right. We did see some evidence that we looked at vacant land in some big cities and asked the question, essentially, property that's been owned longer, was it less likely to be developed? And we saw a significant drop-off in the likelihood of property being developed the longer it was owned, and essentially the higher the property, the Prop 13 tax benefit was.
Yeah, and I think the numbers you came up with were, if you owned property 5 to 10 years, you were 4 times more likely to be developed than if you owned property for 20 to 25 years. That's a pretty substantial difference. Well, Carolyn, let me ask you this. The effect of Prop 13 on the housing industry, has it increased impact fees for developers?
So we looked at the median impact fee over time since about the early 90s, and we did see that the median impact fee for a residential building permit, so to build a house essentially, has increased about 150%. So we have seen a notable increase since the early 90s in impact fees. We also looked at the relative difference in impact fees in cities where a parcel tax, which is like a flat fee property tax.
It seems like they got all these different ways to get you, an impact fee, a parcel tax.
So we looked at cities that were able to pass a parcel tax as compared to cities that either failed to pass a parcel tax or did not put a parcel tax to the voters. And what we saw there was that the impact fees were much higher in cities, the median impact fees were much higher in cities that had not passed a parcel tax as compared to the ones that passed.
Nature
a parcel
pours
tax.
A vacuum, so if you can't get money from the parcel tax, you go get it from the impact fee.
Right, so what we're seeing is a shift from property taxes to these other types of fees, potentially.
Well, let me ask you this. There's another thing called an assessment. Another way to tax you. Did that increase after Prop 13?
What we looked at were specifically mellow roofs taxes, so taxes for typically infrastructure development associated with new housing communities. And we did see an increase in about 130% on average in terms of those types of special taxes to pay for what had historically been paid for by the property
tax. You know,
I
wanted to ask though for clarification. So you've got a parcel tax, you've got an impact fee, and you've got an assessment, three different things. Which one of those needs voter approval? It would seem that if you need voter approval, that would be the hardest to get, and those that don't would be the easiest to get.
Parcel taxes require voter approval, as do mellow roofs taxes.
Assessment.
In that case, though, for mellow roofs, if a community developer owns all the parcels, that can be the only voter.
Right, so
for
they
that
say yes,
tax.
And they simply pass on the tax to the purchaser.
Right, and the mellow roofs tax is carried on by the ultimate property owner.
Okay, but the other one, the impact fee, that can be just simply
right.
Assessed.
Impact fees can be developed by the city and placed upon developers without any voter approval.
So Brian, has Prop 13 increased or decreased home ownership?
That's a little bit of a complicated question, and the answer is sort of yes, that it's both increased and decreased depending on sort of the cohort of people you're looking at. So we did find some evidence that among, say, older homeowners or fixed-income retirees, that there was some evidence that it might be promoting home ownership among that group.
But that was a problem pre-Prop 13, that some of these older people on fixed incomes couldn't pay the increased property taxes.
That's right. And on the flip side, we see that some of these increase in fees and Mellor Roos taxes that we were just talking about, that a lot of that burden is being borne by newer, younger homeowners.
That means they're having a harder time.
And we're seeing falling homeownership rates among that group. So the answer is sort of yes, it's probably both increased and decreased depending on
and,
who
and it depends on where you are in that equation, whether you like it or not, I suppose. Well, up next, we're going to talk about the bottom line impact of Prop 13 on local government. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. Proposition 13 created a seismic shift on how local governments do business. The question is, has it made local government better or worse? We're talking to two experts on Proposition 13, Carolyn Chu and Brian Euler from the Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst's Office, about the impact of Proposition 13 40 years on. Carolyn, let me ask you, there's a general sense that local governments have seen a significant drop in revenue as a result of Prop 13. Is that really the case?
Well, when Proposition 13 passed, local governments' property tax revenues dropped precipitously, 60% at the time. Since then, property taxes have increased a bit over 100%, adjusted for inflation. In addition, other types of taxes, sales taxes, hotel taxes, utility taxes, have increased over 600%. Overall, though, local governments, particularly cities and counties, their tax revenue has actually declined in real dollars since the time 13 passed.
So you were talking about, you know, overall though, the revenue for local communities, is it kind of reached the point where it was, I guess, adjusting for inflation prior to 13?
So for their tax revenue, local governments, cities and counties in particular, have for the most part caught back up with their property tax losses of 13 through their sales, hotel, and utility taxes. So at the time, they lost about $10 billion in revenue in real dollars, so today's dollars, and now they raise about $8.5 billion in those alternative types of taxes.
So it sounds like traditionally property taxes were where it's at for revenue for local governments, but that's now changed because of Prop 13.
That's right.
And it's changed kind of the mix of tax revenue. So we're talking about the hotel tax and the sales tax and all those kinds of things. So talk a little more about that.
Sure. So at the time Proposition 13 passed, property taxes made up almost 100% of cities and counties' revenues. Today, property taxes are just over 60% of their tax revenues. And the things that fill that gap are the sales tax, the hotel tax, utility
tax. Hotel tax is really great because other people pay it as they're coming through town, right? So
they do.
I assume they're pretty popular.
They do. They are not typically borne by the residents.
Right. So I interrupted you. Sales tax, hotel, and utility
and
taxes.
And utility taxes,
okay.
Yes.
And the cities and counties can kind of control that to some
they
extent.
They can raise those locally, yes.
Okay. So Brian, it's kind of interesting. You hear a lot about the fiscalization of land use. The idea that, you know, in fact, I've even been told by a local politician that, you know, they'll put a car dealership in a neighborhood because it generates tax revenue. Because there's an incentive there because they're getting a sales tax on the sale of cars as opposed to a house, which they're not making really any money on. In fact, I think housing actually probably ends up costing a community probably as opposed to the sales taxes. So is that true that now communities are thinking we got to get more of these kinds of retail businesses, hotels, car dealerships that are going to generate, you know, some revenue for us?
Well, there's certainly a lot of, as you said, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that's been presented to sort of argue for this fiscalization of land use effect. And what we tried to look at to see if there really was a systematic effect of Prop 13 on land use decisions. And, you know, we essentially compared the types of land use decisions that cities were making based on whether or not they were more or less dependent on sales tax and whether they received a higher or lower share of property tax. And the theory being that, for example, a city that was receiving a higher share of the local property tax, they would get more benefit from approving a new housing unit, and so they might be more inclined to approve housing. We didn't see that in the data.
These are the pre-1978 rates adjusted for the 2%.
That's right. Yeah. And okay. So you would think that the ones with the higher share be more inclined to approve housing. We didn't see that was true. We also might think that the cities that were more dependent on sales tax would be more inclined to approve retail developments, and we didn't see that in the data as well. So there wasn't a lot in the data that we looked at to suggest that there was a systematic effect.
When you saw the data, you say this is counterintuitive.
I think we were honestly surprised. It does go against, like, again, a lot of sort of anecdotal reports, a lot of, you know, even what theory would suggest here. So you know, I think that probably taking our results with a little bit of caution that. We only looked at a recent decade of data, And certainly, potentially, someone else could look at the data different, come to different results. But we did what we thought was a reasonable.
Yeah, I looked when I saw that in your report. I said, that's really interesting because it's not what I would have expected. Quickly, the last question, Carolyn, when I ask you, I assume that there are some things that Proposition 13 has done. It's stabilized property rates, I assume, property taxes.
So what we looked at was whether or not property taxes were differentially stable before and after Proposition 13. And in terms of the revenue to local governments, what we found was that the revenue they received before and the revenue they received after were relatively similarly stable. The reason for this is that local governments could change their rates year to year before Proposition 13 to adjust for changes in market
value. So it
hasn't
made it any less stable.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I want to thank our guests, Brian Euler and Carolyn Chu, for being with us. If you want to stay up on local and state politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.com.
Up next, a recent California Supreme Court decision has many wondering if Prop 13 may just have been nullified, at least when it comes to local, citizen-initiated tax increases. We'll get the details and perspective from Leon Dillum of the LA Times, John Kapal from the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, and we'll discuss the political implications with Dan Walters of Cal Matters and John Myers of the LA Times.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
Ever since Prop 13 was passed in 1978, city and county governments have needed a two-thirds supermajority to raise taxes. And tax measures for a specific purpose, like public safety, parks, libraries, or zoos, could only be put before the voters during a general election. A recent California Supreme Court decision, however, may have changed the rules of the game, at least when it comes to special taxes. What are the implications? We'll ask. Liam Dillon with the LA Times. John Kapal with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Dan Walters with Cal Matters. And John Myers of the LA Times.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. Chevron's Coalinga oil field and Fresno County have been doing side by side for over 100 years. Learn more at doers.com. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. To some, Prop 13, passed in 1978, not only protected California homeowners from ever-increasing property taxes, it also protected California taxpayers from the drip, drip, drip of new taxes. To others, however, it's hamstrung the ability of local governments to raise money to address problems. Recently, a California Supreme Court decision has folks on both sides wondering if the fiscal landscape has changed. Our guest is Liam Dillon with the Los Angeles Times, been following this decision. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you for having me.
So let's set the stage. Prop 13 and 78 and a progeny of other props, and props that have propped up Prop 13, right?
Sure.
Can you briefly explain kind of the anti-tax measures that have followed Prop 13?
Yeah, so it's sort of been this kind of cat and mouse game ever since Prop 13 got
passed. Looking
for
an angle.
Exactly. So you have cities saying, we want more revenue, and anti-tax measures keep coming to say, well, maybe you shouldn't get it. And so there's been this played out a lot in the courts and on ballot initiatives over really the 80s and much of the 90s. And so what happened is there was a distinction between taxes, which are sort of general purpose, sales tax, property tax, and then fees, which is, oh, here's a service, you should pay for it, and so that everyone's gotten kind of more creative with that. And this back and forth in the courts and everything kind of came to a head in the mid-90s with Prop 218, which just sort of definitively said, if you're a local government if you're a local government trying to raise money in a general way, so higher taxes for just for your general fund, that would take a majority vote. But if you want to do it for a particular purpose, so
Special taxes.
Exactly. So to fund fire and police or to fund road repairs, that's what takes a two-thirds.
Okay. Yeah. And I think I was reading that the reason why they did that was they figured it was harder, the anti-tax groups figured it was harder to pass a general tax, so they could go with the lower threshold, but the special tax might get more support, so they wanted to raise the threshold on that.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the recent Supreme Court ruling that has local governments hopeful and anti-tax advocates up in arms.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the case? What was the issue before the court? What did the court rule?
So it was really interesting because the case on its face really had nothing to do with this sort of tax question. It was about a fee for cannabis dispensaries in Upland in San Bernardino County. And so people that proposed this sort of fee said, we're going to pay $75,000 so you can regulate us, and you need to put that on the ballot. And the city came back and said, that's too much money, that's a tax, and so we're going to treat you differently.
So it's a little more money than they actually needed to take care of the problem. That went into the general fund, therefore it became a general tax.
That was the argument of the city. And okay. So the cannabis backers sued and said, no, we should be treated like a fee, and that sort of started this chain of events where we came to a point where there was a question of whether something on the ballot proposed by an outside group should be treated differently than something put on the ballot proposed by elected officials.
Okay, so that leads us kind of the question of what are the implications of this decision? For example, when cities or municipalities want to go out for bond measures, they usually support those with special taxes. So does that mean if a citizen or a special interest group now proposes a special tax, it doesn't need a two-thirds supermajority to pass? It just needs a simple majority?
Right. So what the court said something very clear, but the implications of what that was is very muddy. So the very clear thing the court said is taxes proposed by outside groups should be treated differently than taxes proposed by elected officials, and that's because we sort of jealously guard, in the language of the court, the people's power to change policy, and that sort of trumps everything else. And so they made that very clear distinction. So what that means, though, it's unclear for whether this two-thirds threshold for local taxes proposed by initiative changes or not. We still don't know. So we had a clear ruling. These things are different, but the implications of that are still muddy.
So what's the consensus then in terms of how far reaching this ruling is going to be?
I think because the decision is kind of muddy on that point, whether this sort of threshold changes, that we're going to need to see more litigation or more cases that kind of test this before we get a clear understanding of whether this distinction on initiative versus ballot measures proposed by elected officials will really be meaningful in terms of how local governments raise their money.
So I think you just predicted the future. And the future is going to be what? More litigation, maybe more propositions to further define it? Is this going to be a continuation of what we've seen for the last 30 years?
I think so. And you're already seeing some reaction from this. The Howard Jarvis Taxpayer Association, which is sort of jealously guards the protections under Prop 13, has asked Republican lawmakers who have abided in both the Senate and the Assembly to propose a ballot measure that would definitively close any potential loophole that were here, basically saying anything that was a special tax, no matter who proposed it, that would be two-thirds.
I want to thank our guest, Liam Dillon, with the Los Angeles Times, for that insight on the court's decision. Up next, we're going to talk to the president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, John Kapal, to see what he thinks about this decision. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. No group is more identified with Prop 13 than the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, named after the anti-tax activist responsible for the passage of Prop 13 in 1978. Our guest is the president of that organization, John Kapal. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Pleasure to be here, Mark. Thank you.
So let's start off with a little bit of a philosophical question. What would you say to those that say, democracies are all about rule of the majority, and then when you have this super minority two-thirds requirement, you're really thwarting the will of the majority?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd point out the United States Constitution has a two-thirds vote requirement in 12 different places, including for impeachment and treaties. And so we use supermajorities when there is a desire or a policy to get a greater consensus. We use supermajorities all the time. For example, in a criminal trial, it's way above two-thirds. It's unanimous. In order to deprive someone of life or liberty, you need a unanimous vote of a 12-person jury. In California, over and over again, in fact, going back to the 1800s, as it relates to bonds, we've had a two-thirds vote requirement for important financial decisions, especially bonded in debt, and also for taxes. So this is a policy that's been ratified by California voters over and again the last 100 years, that when it comes to government's most draconian power, which is the ability to extract dollars from people's pockets, we're going to subject that to a two-thirds vote.
You know, there are some that would say, that looking at a little research, there were 14 special tax measures in the state that failed after getting a majority of votes. So they passed the 50% threshold but didn't get the two-thirds. There were even three that got 66.6%, didn't pass, needed 66.7%. Two-thirds, kind of an arbitrary number?
No, well, it's not arbitrary. I suppose you could say that the 12 references to a two-thirds vote in the United States Constitution is arbitrary. I'd like it to be four-fifths. I mean, we could sit here and debate all day what the precise number should be. But again, the two-thirds vote has historical resonance with California voters. And when it relates to some of those local taxes, mm-hmm. here's the important thing to remember. Many of those were parcel taxes, which are paid exclusively by property owners. And in California, as in all states, we give the franchise to everybody, including those who don't own property. So it's always easy to raise somebody else's taxes. What's the old saying? Don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the man behind the tree.
Right, right.
So again, I think the two-thirds vote, particularly when it relates to property taxes, is a reasonable check.
Well, let me ask you about this. You know, they have that recent Supreme Court decision. You called
sure.
it stunning. You said that, quote, it imperils every California taxpayer. Why do you believe that?
Well, the case, really very interesting and kind of arcane. It had to do with a marijuana coalition. And people said, well, Jarvis, are you taking sides in the marijuana debate? No, we're not. But an upshot of the ruling was whether or not local initiatives had to comply with the same rules that local government have to comply with.
So a citizen-initiated initiative.
A local citizen initiative. Now, this had to do with the timing of an election. The Cannabis Coalition wanted a special election, and the city of Upland wanted it to be on the general election, referring to our initiative, Proposition 218, the Right to Vote on Taxes Act. The Court of Appeal decision was negative, and we represented, interestingly enough, kind of man bites dog. The Jarvis Association represented the city of Upland.
The League of Cities is actually kind of siding with you on this a little
bit. Yeah, very interesting, because the League of Cities kinds of views this as the potential of special interest groups, whether it's labor or sports, as usurping their taxes.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, because it says citizen initiative, but that could be put forward by any special interest group. That's one of your concerns, isn't it?
Yes. And you know, from our perspective, if, for example, if a city was at impasse with one of their unions, they would say, we don't have any more money for raises. The unions would say, well, we'll find a way to give you more money. We'll go out and do our own initiative, and we'll present it to you, a simple majority vote, or perhaps no vote at all on a tax increase.
Or developers could do it as
or
well.
We've seen it with developers, and we've seen it with sports stadiums. In fact, the one case that's percolating right now deals with a hotel tax in San Diego. After this ruling, a bunch of the hotel owners are looking at this saying, we think we can get this special tax with a simple majority vote.
So where do you go from here?
Well, first of all, we have filed a petition for rehearing, which is pending before the California Supreme Court right now. The political lineup here from the outside makes no sense, because we've had local governments come in on the side of Jarvis, which almost never happens, saying, pointing out that the original decision of the Supreme Court was very unusual insofar as it seemed to elevate the power of the local initiative above the local government's own power. We have taken the position, and we're big defenders of the initiative process, but we've always said what's good for the goose is good for the ganders. The people's power of local initiative should be coextensive with that of the local government. If the local government can do it, so can the local voters. But the local voters don't have any greater power.
Two-thirds for everybody requirement.
Right, exactly.
Okay, well, I want to thank John Kapal from the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Up next, what do longtime political observers think? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. You know, everyone's wondering the practical implications of the Supreme Court's decision that may have just created an exception for citizen-initiated taxes. Fortunately, we've got two of the best political observers in state politics to help figure that out, the prolific LA Times journalist John Myers and the longtime columnist Dan Walters from Cal Matters, who I read on Twitter recently. Someone was suggesting that maybe we name the state dinosaur after you. That was a compliment. You're an institution.
Yeah. Or should be in an institution, one or the other.
Well, we just had, recently we had John Kapal on talking about this decision. He thinks it's going to lead public sector unions, developers, and others to have a rash of tax proposals. Do you think that's going to happen?
I think, I don't know about a rash, but I think there could be some. What it does is it potentially reduces the vote requirement for so-called special taxes, those for just certain purposes, specified purposes, from two-thirds to one simple majority, if it's done by citizens' initiative as opposed to being done by the city council or county board of supervisors. I think it could, because throughout the state, a lot of cities have been trying tax sales tax overrides for police and fire, i.e. police and fire, but really for pensions. Right. And a lot of them have failed.
That's the big hole.
A lot of them have failed. And this is an easy way out to reduce that vote requirement. So I could see police and fire unions using this to try to get more money to pay for their pension costs, basically. So
a public safety initiative coming to a town near you. Let me ask you, John, about what the League of Cities is doing, which I found really interesting. The California League of Cities, the fiscal policy advisor, stated it didn't like this idea. He said it's going to fragment and ossify budgets and put other groups that don't have guaranteed sources of funding more at risk during economic downturns. So it looks like we have a very strange situation of political bedfellows with the League of Cities and the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. What's up with that?
I don't know. I would subscribe that this might be a one-time kind of aligning of those planets. I mean, I think if you look in a lot of entities in government, local government, state government, the people who interact with them, they don't like uncertainty. I mean, you hear that from the business community a lot, right? And so you've left local government in this uncertainty about which avenue gets you revenue in different places. I think it's important to say two other things about this topic, Mark. The first one is, no one is sure whether it sets a precedent beyond this case up from the little community of Upland, where it was all about medical marijuana and taxes and the setup there. And the second one is I think voters are often confused in the state that statewide ballot measures for taxes are a simple majority. I hear this all the time as a reporter. Mm-hmm. Well, is that a two-thirds vote to pass Prop whatever on the statewide ballot? No. Mm-hmm. But on the local level, we have had this unusual system that has raised voter confusion and now has a bit of a legal uncertainty to it. So yeah, they're concerned, but I don't know that you've got people who are going to be simpatico after this on everything.
Let me ask you this, Dan, about election day shopping. You're looking for the right time to put the initiative on the ballot. That happens already. Is it going to happen even more as a result of
this decision? I think if this thing does result in a flurry of, maybe not a rash, but a flurry of local ballot measures for new taxes, there will be some election shopping. Does it work better if there's a high turnout general election or a low turnout special election or a low turnout primary election? It depends on the circumstance. Depends on what you're proposing, depends on who's proposing it, and depends on the tenor of that particular community at that particular time.
You know, in
time.
Some ways I could see it might really help a public sector unions because they can get the vote out in special elections, right? And so if it's a police, a public safety kind of issue, they'll get their people out to vote.
Well, yeah, but also in low turnout elections, they tend to be more conservative voters.
Right, so yeah, there is that dynamic. So,
well, I think the key part here is how big is the jurisdiction you're talking about, right? The larger the city, the county, the harder it is to kind of get your electorate by bringing those people out. To your part, Mark, you get a smaller one, maybe so.
Yeah. Let me ask this, John. Litigation, it seems like it's been following Prop 13 and its progeny.
Everything about government has litigation, yeah.
Okay. Right. So it's like death and taxes, litigation over Prop 13 and all this stuff. We're just going to see more litigation?
First and foremost, I think there are a couple of things. The first one is, does the law need to be changed? Will it be changed? And there's talk about a ballot measure and trying to get something on the statewide ballot in 2018. You've seen Republicans in Sacramento introduce a measure, which we can talk about in a moment. But prior to that, the question becomes, right, do the courts have to weigh back in? And again, I'm not a lawyer, so full disclosure, but in reading the opinions from the state Supreme Court, it's not clear that they believe this to have had a weight beyond this particular place. I mean, yes, one of the justices said that there was a broader notion here, but sure, I think we could easily see it back in court until someone adjudicates this at the ballot box, which is how we do things in California, some change to the law.
Us lawyers call that dicta, and that means that they're opining on things that really don't have to do with the issue before them, and so we don't know what that really means. Let me ask you this last question, Dan, about the unintended consequences. Do you see any unintended consequences with this?
There are always unintended consequences. Any time the law changes on anything, there's always unintended consequences. It could affect, I think, possibly this weird situation in which general tax increases only require a simple majority vote. Special tax increases require a two-thirds vote. Now, if special taxes can only require a simple majority vote if they're on initiative, it might encourage people to use the general tax. I don't know. You don't know.
Right.
But there will be consequences.
But look at that flow chart that Dan just laid out, right? It becomes harder and harder for elected officials and the voters to understand what that means.
We're going to talk about the political implications of this decision in a moment. This is the Maddy Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddy Institute. So what are the political implications of the recent California Supreme Court decision on citizen-initiated taxes? We're talking to Dan Walters with Cal Matters and John Myers with the LA Times. So, John, let me ask you, assume there is this rush by government officials to advance tax proposals using kind of bogus grassroots groups as fronts. Couldn't that lead to another anti-tax backlash?
Maybe, but let me just poke a hole in the premise of that just a little bit, which is, yes, I think the critics of this ruling say, right, we'll have these kind of Trojan horse efforts to pass taxes. But maybe, just maybe, other side of the coin, you have local officials sitting down with some of local groups and talking about the best way to do stuff and having buy-in to get tax measures that way. I mean, it could be, I think the point is it could, if it's broad enough, and we've already said that we don't know if it's broad enough, it could lead to a different discussion about taxation and services on the local level. I think everybody would think that's a good. I do think that the critics of this worry it's a way to kind of sneak something in there, but maybe not.
We have to also remember, Mark, that this is not going to affect property taxes. This is going to affect the only taxes that could be raised by this, probably, are either so-called parcel taxes or sales taxes. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to affect the Proposition 13's basic function, which is to limit property taxes.
There is actually a proposal I'd read put forward by the real estate industry that they're talking about cutting those property taxes in some way. But, you know, 2018, it could turn out to be the year of taxes, right? We've got the gas tax that they might want to overturn. They've got this decision that they're concerned about. What's the chance we're going to see something on the ballot?
I think the chances we're going to see something on the ballot on either of those points, either the gas tax or this thing, are pretty slender, to tell you the truth, because they would be pushed by groups, Republicans and people like Mr. Kapal's organization, that have no money to do any of this. And they would face very stiff opposition from a lot of money from unions. And it's probably not going to happen.
I think I just saw something that some of the groups supporting the gas tax said they'd put $40 million into a campaign.
It would not only be the unions in that case, but a lot of business groups, like State Chamber of Commerce.
And there are two different topics here, right? I mean, this one that we've been talking about how you pass tax increases, and one as to whether or not, you know, which could become a sentimental campaign about roads and bridges and repairs and other things. But at the end of the day, even if you do get it on the ballot, I think Dan's exactly right, it's hard to get on the ballot. Even if you get it on the ballot, do you have the money to run an effective campaign? And you're going to have people who are going to run a no campaign on both of those, probably.
What if you just get it on the ballot and that encourages like-minded voters, Republicans, to come to the polls and maybe it'll help you in legislative races? Will that have any
influence? Now you're starting to think like one of those people over at the Capitol. If we do this, will it do that? If that happens, will this happen? I think everybody ought to relax about this whole thing. I don't think anything's going to happen, to tell you the truth, for the most part. I think you will see some more local tax increases proposed, sales tax override, half a cent or a quarter cent. Are you going to see some big statewide huge thing happen out of this? I don't think so.
What do you think, John?
I think Dan's right on that. It would be interesting, though, wouldn't it, if you have a local issue, because we've seen issues. In San Diego, they've talked about money. In other communities, they've talked about it. Whether someone puts something on the ballot and then we see what vote total it gets, and then we see somebody to go to court and say what vote total should it have been held under. That seems more likely to me than someone galvanizing some large statewide angst about it.
You know, it seems like the core message of the Republican Party has been anti-tax. But you're hearing a little more moderate tone from some other folks, like San Diego Mayor Kevin Faulkner or the former Republican Assembly leader, Chad.
Stress former.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. I'm going to ask John first.
Yeah.
You know, so they're arguing for a more moderate approach. Are they talking about the future of the Republican Party, or are they talking about the past?
I don't know. I mean, I think first it's a question about anti-tax, low tax, reasonable tax rate. This is where politics gets made about the messaging on some of this. I think if you talk to some of these Republicans, it's not so much that they have had a conversion on taxes. I think that they have looked at their registration numbers and looked at the rhetoric and realized that the conversation politically in the state is not working in their favor. And they've got to find a different way to have the conversation. Are they going to all of a sudden start embracing tax increases? No. But are they going to talk about pragmatism or thoughtfulness? Maybe, because they're looking for those voters who have left them in droves.
We're talking about Chad Mays, the former Assembly Minority Leader. He was saying, hey, we got to get with the program. He supported cap and trade. New vision for the Republican Party?
Well, this happens periodically. Every once in a while, somebody wakes up and realizes the Republican Party is going down the tubes and decides we have to do something differently. Jim Brulte, who's now the state Republican chairman, used to say that back when he was the Senate. We can't be the anti-immigrant party. We can't be seen as the anti-woman party. We have to get with the program. And the Republicans have continued to decline. In fact, interestingly enough, I just saw some data the other day. Jim Brulte's own hometown of Rancho Cucamonga now has a Democratic majority. So things have changed quite dramatically. And the Republicans are looking desperately to try to retain some relevance in the state. But if the current trends continue over the next couple of election cycles, they're going to become now the third party behind independents.
Well, I want to thank Dan Walters from Cal Matters, John Myers from the LA Times, Liam Dillon also from the LA Times, and John Kapal from the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. This is Mark Kepler for the Matter Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed on the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Matter Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.